Wu, coming to you for a final lecture as part of the WHO Patient Safety Research Introductory Course. This is section 8 out of 8 sessions. And today we're going to be talking about knowledge strengthening for patient safety. I hope you've enjoyed this series as much as I have. We have been brought to you, as mentioned, by WHO Patient Safety, and we are also going out to you on the rafts through the hospital of the University of Geneva. I'm actually sitting in Baltimore at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. For those of you who are interested, all of these sessions have been recorded, including the question and answers, and the answers to the questions and answers. And these are available on the WHO Patient Safety website. As I've mentioned before, I'm actually recording simultaneously or transmitting simultaneously on two different PCs. So if I look away from the camera or if simply be that I'm trying to figure out the other PC. So today, in our last session today, we're going to try to reflect a little on questions and comments while we review some of the most important information from the previous sessions. We're going to also suggest how to advance learning and where one might find. And what I'm going to begin with is to review key messages from our first 7 lectures. Some of you may be disappointed, but there is no quiz today since this is all review. So from our very first lecture given by Professor David Bates, perhaps central to all of our discussion about patient safety is a transforming concept which is inherent in the definition of patient safety. When we say patient safety, we imply that there are times when patients are not safe. In fact, that errors are common in healthcare, and much of what we need to do is to understand how those errors occur and prevent them, and also prevent them from causing harm, because again, they are inevitable. The real transforming concept is that errors are much more a property of systems and how we have designed our work, how we have organized it, what we have decided to do in managerial decisions, in planning, than it is a property of individuals. So safety is a property of systems. And the corollary of this is that it really makes no sense to punish people for making errors. People are valuable. They are expensive to train. It takes a long time. It's difficult to retain them sometimes. And even if you punish those people, you will still have the system problems remaining. You can't really improve systems in general by punishing people. And when you do, in addition, the other people are much less willing to admit that error exists, which is something, of course, which is undeniable. The second corollary is you can decrease errors by improving systems. And that's much of what this course is about. And also studying how that may be done. Concept of safety culture. This is really part of the greater culture that exists in healthcare organizations. And safety culture A good safety culture exhibits five properties or attributes that healthcare professionals strive to operationalize through strong safety management systems. The first is a culture where all workers, including frontline staff, nurses, physicians, others, and their managers, accept responsibility for safety. Safety is everyone's job. It's not just something that someone else takes care of. And we have responsibilities for safety beyond our simple responsibility to take care of patients, which of course is not so simple. Two, this is a culture that prioritizes safety above financial and operational goals. Safety first. Above all, first, do no harm. Third is a safety culture is one that encourages and rewards the identification of communication, the identification, communication, and resolution of safety issues, rather than punishing individuals for telling about problems in safety. In fact, they should be rewarded because it's difficult to do. It takes courage. A safety culture is one that learns from accidents and mistakes. And finally, a safety culture provides appropriate resources, structure, and accountability to maintain effective safety systems. So there is leadership also. Some themes that have emerged from all of the lectures in this series are that first, it's very apparent that patient safety is a problem in all nations of the world. Definitions of what we are talking about, what is safety, what is an error, what is an adverse event, definitions are important so we can count the same things. What is a healthcare infection? What is a wound infection? What is a medical error in a particular context? Some other common themes include issues with human performance, because of course people work within systems, and the science of human factors engineering. What we are trying to do in many ways is re-examine and re-engineer our work, of which consists of people working within those systems. Communication is also crucially important. We certainly need more information about the frequency of adverse events and errors by particular country and setting. It is not enough to know what's going on in developed countries. We can't rely entirely on those well to other contexts. And so research is needed to identify and describe safety issues and then to develop and test safety solutions. This, again, is what this course is all about. This is the now familiar patient safety research cycle. And the components are measuring harm, understanding causes, identifying solutions, evaluating the impact of those solutions, and translating evidence into safer care. These five domains of patient safety research are helpful to keep in mind as we think about things that we can do. In many cases, the selection of the study type that we will use to address each of these different domains may differ because different methods, different measurement methods are more appropriate for certain tasks. Some methods are better for identifying problems. Other methods are better for evaluating solutions. What we do, of course, also depends on resources available. And qualitative and quantitative studies are both valuable tools. One thing which we definitely need more of is evaluation of solutions to problems. Very often, in our rush to make things better, we put solutions in place, but they're never, ever evaluated. And we really don't know in the end whether or not they're working unless there's some earth-shaking result. In order to evaluate solutions, we have to define our problem carefully and precisely. Not necessarily too much data, but enough data so that we can see how we're doing and then make further actions. What are we trying to measure? We're trying to measure a few things. Errors, and these are some of those common definitions. Errors are, an error can be defined as by the Institute of Medicine as the failure of a planned action to be completed as intended, or the use of a wrong plan to achieve an aim. There are two kinds of errors. Latent errors are really problems with system design, poor design, understaffing, under-resourcing. Active errors are the things that we think of mostly as errors, errors that are made by frontline staff, often that are visible. We might call these mistakes, for example, an error in dosing a medication. However, there are many more latent errors than there are active errors. Adverse events are simply harm to patients caused by healthcare. Some adverse events are caused by errors. Others are simply the statistically expected complications of procedures. Some targets that we are particularly interested in, though there are more, medication errors, hospital acquired infections, surgical complications, device complications, patient identification errors, and of course death. Oh, I should say that I've skipped ahead a little bit. We needn't stick to which lecture each of these points came from, but we've already passed through Professor Bates' second lecture, and now we're on to our third lecture, which was on measuring harm. Actually, I won't say any more about that in particular. All of these messages, I think, run through all of the sessions in our course. There are perhaps four basic methods for collecting data in general in clinical research observation. By healthcare workers or occasionally patients. Testing more often of healthcare workers, occasionally of patients in safety studies, and then review of physical evidence like medical records, or for that matter, even electronic records. There are many measurement methods that exist that are commonly used in patient in nature. Prospective methods include direct observations of patient care, often done at the bedside. Cohort studies, which are, of course, no different than cohort studies in any other kind of clinical research. Clinical surveillance, in which measures are built into clinical processes, so they are collected routinely. For example, oxygen saturation in the blood is collected routinely during all operations, all surgical procedures, when the patient has anesthesia. So you can see if there are times when the oxygen saturation dips too low for any amount of time. A culture is taken routinely of any wound so that you can see later what infection may be present. Retrospective designs include record review, particularly of charts, administrative claims analysis if those data are collected for billing or other purposes, malpractice claims analyses, which are a special kind of and mortality conferences and autopsies are special measurement methods that are quite clinical but can be revealing. And incident reporting systems or reporting and learning systems are systems that exist to systematically collect information after errors or adverse events are detected. As I alluded to earlier, this is a paper by Eric Thomas and Laura Peterson, which talks about the relative utility of different methods to measure errors. And some methods are better for measuring latent errors, such as incident reports, malpractice claims, autopsies, morbidity and mortality conferences. These are better at detecting latent errors because they are from many perspectives. Many people are observing the same incident and can report from their perspective what happened. This can tell you about latent errors that are hiding in the system, traps that are designed into the system. On the other end, adverse events, harm to patients is very well collected by clinical surveillance. For example, collecting systematically in the lab every case of a bloodstream infection. Active errors are probably best captured by direct observation of care, since they are at the front line, at the sharp end of patient care. And chart review, administrative data analysis, analysis of information technology are somewhere in between. Direct observation is a method which makes a lot of clinical sense. It's good for active errors, observing clinical processes at the point where the patient and the healthcare workers interact. These data are often not available in any other way, and this is potentially a very accurate and precise way of measuring. It's highly valid for what you can see, and it's quite precise. It's reliable. Two different observers might be able to observe, collect the same piece of information. As long as you use standardized methods and train people in how to do this. Training is necessary, which makes this more expensive. It's time consuming. Observers can sometimes be overloaded by things. They can't capture everything. There can be Hawthorne effects. People can change their behavior. Clinical surveillance are principal tools of clinical research and are potentially accurate and precise for adverse events. They're very helpful to test the effectiveness of an intervention to decrease a specific adverse event. If you know when the intervention happened, if you know what you're trying to capture, then you can do before and after, or even clinical trial designs. And see if the intervention, clinical surveillance, these measurements become part of standard care. Chart review uses data that's readily available already and can be used retrospectively as long as there is a medical record that's in which things are recorded systematically. It's common to almost all systems. There's some problems. One is that judgments of adverse events is sometimes not reliable. Two different reviewers or readers of a chart might disagree about whether or not an adverse event occurred. It's a little bit expensive. You need to often have clinically educated people read the charts. Records can certainly be missing or incomplete. And again, you have hindsight bias. If you see that the patient died, you may be more vigilant or more likely to judge an incident as being inadequate care. Provider surveys are good for latent errors. providers can tell you what happened over time, what they were thinking about problems they had observed in the system. And by surveying a lot of people, you can tap into what we call the wisdom of crowds, as James Surowiecki, in his book by that name, has pointed out. Provider surveys can be quite comprehensive. You can ask about lots of things. They do have some problems. There's hindsight bias. Again, bad outcome. If there was a bad outcome in a case, a provider may remember things selectively. You also do need to get a good response rate if you're trying to measure things at the unit of an organization, because otherwise the results will not be generalizable. A rule of thumb is that you need at least a 70% response rate from a single unit to be able to generalize the results. Malpractice claims analysis are good for looking at latent errors also sometimes, because you get data from multiple perspectives, and often the results of an investigation. Again, we have problems with hindsight bias and with reporting bias. Malpractice claims are also not standardized. Different claims from different malpractice, from different companies or different malpractice lawyers look different. So they're a little harder to work with. Reporting and learning systems, or incident reporting systems, can be helpful for detecting latent errors. Providers from different perspectives over time, they can become a standard procedure. And in many organizations, many incidents will be reported. At our own hospital, at Johns Hopkins, there are 10 or 15,000 incidents reported every year. Some people think that we are a good hospital, but there are many errors, and in fact, quite a few injuries that happen because of healthcare every day. And clinicians can get into the habit of reporting. There are, again, reporting and hindsight biases in using these data. So in summary, different methods to measure and to understand errors and adverse events have different strengths and weaknesses. And we've just gone through a very quick review of some of those. Mixed methods, such as we have examined in the course, studies such as those from Philippe Michel, which used two or three different methods, some qualitative, some quantitative, can help improve understanding as the methods can complement each other. Moving on to solutions, there are two types of solutions that we really talked about. One is the case where you have a problem, and you don't know what the solution might be. And if that solution is not yet identified, there are a number of designs that can be helpful. Pre-post designs, before and after a proposed intervention, randomized for the efficacy and perhaps effectiveness of an intervention, depending on how the trial is structured. You can have different kinds of randomization, such as cluster randomization, which make things easier to do in a group of units or organizations. In the case where there is a known solution, the evaluations that we talk about, when there's a known solution, we are aiming first to improve the reliability of what we already know to be an effective practice, and then we're trying to measure the reliability of delivery. I should emphasize that interventions can be at several levels. We tend to aim our interventions at healthcare workers, or perhaps at a unit at the workplace, but we can intervene at the level of the patient, of different healthcare workers, at the workplace, and in fact at a whole hospital or even higher system also, depending on goals. Oh, this is a little bit of a hierarchy of research evidence. Perhaps the best evidence is provided by systematic reviews of many clinical trials conducted, hopefully, on different populations and in different settings. A single randomized trial is the next strongest evidence, though they provide better evidence for efficacy than effectiveness. Cohort studies can perhaps provide the best evidence for effectiveness, care as it's used in routine practice by usual practitioners as opposed to experts. Case-controlled studies can be very powerful, particularly for rare outcomes. Case series and case reports are commonly used but do not provide very strong evidence, though sometimes they have such face validity that they can be helpful. Editorials and expert opinions, unfortunately, are much of what we work from but are not strong research evidence. There are stronger interventions in general and weaker interventions. This is a figure from a just published paper by Woodward and colleagues in the Annual Review of Public Health. This was, in fact, a product from a team based largely the World Health Organization's Patient Safety Program. And the strongest interventions involve automation or forcing functions. Forcing functions are when you arrange things so that it is hard to do the wrong thing, so that it is easy, the default is to do the right thing. Simplifying processes can work similarly. Checklists can help you miss things, can produce redundancy or safety checks. Computerized order entry can make it harder to make certain kinds of errors. Reducing work can reduce all kinds of errors. Standardizing procedures like standardizing handovers, standard readbacks, standardizing communications are stronger. These they are weaker in many ways. The weakest are admonitions, scolding people and telling them to be more careful, be more vigilant. Randomized controlled trials, of course, provide the strongest evidence for efficacy. They give you, in particular, control for unmeasured confounders. You can also look at whether or not you have balance of measured baseline variables, but it is the control of unmeasured confounders that is the great strength of randomized controlled trials. However, they require a certain amount of equipoise that is to give the intervention. Other people are reluctant. Some people think it must be given. Other people think it should never be given. This is the time when a trial can be done, and they must also be ethically acceptable. They must be culturally acceptable. And all of these studies that involve human subjects do require ethical review. These are not ideal for effectiveness because group of patients, unless you design things in that way. As far as interventions go, we really need to know a lot still about effective interventions to improve safety. There are many, many studies that need to be done. We need to design our studies carefully and conduct them carefully. There are already, of course, some evidence-based procedures and interventions that we know will improve safety. So we should try to implement them, but we then need to evaluate the implementation. Evidence for an effective procedure is not the same as evidence that implementation is effective. How can we know that we are safer? So in doing these evaluations, We could look at harm. This is an outcome. We could look at whether or not appropriate care is given. These are processes of care explicitly defined. We can see whether learning occurred. If we try to intervene, perhaps by implementing a policy, did they actually, or by prescribing a policy, did a unit or an organization actually write a policy for their organization? Do staff know that it exists? We can actually test their knowledge. Do you know if this policy exists? Does your organization have a policy? Appropriately, the policy might be for hand washing. You can directly observe whether or not people are following that guideline in the way that it should be. We can also measure safety culture, which should change when organizations put meaningful interventions into place. What we generally need when we try to take evidence and translate it into practice, into safer care, we generally need an integrated approach, because this is not easy to do. You cannot simply take a checklist and throw it into a system and assume that it will improve care. To do this, we need to focus on systems. That is how we organize work, rather than the care of individual patients with our interventions. We need to engage local interdisciplinary teams to make sure that leading clinicians take ownership of the project. We need to create centralized support for the technical work, because even very well-meaning clinicians, expert clinicians, won't know all the technical details of how to implement something. We need to encourage local adaptation of the intervention. An intervention taken off the shelf in Baltimore is not likely to work well in other settings without examination and some adaption, particularly to barriers that may exist locally. And finally, we need to create a collaborative culture within units and work, the context for this work. This is a framework from the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, or IHI's. This is a model for improvement from the IHI, which relies on rapid cycle change. But first, you have to ask three questions. One, what are we trying to accomplish? What specific safety goal? How do we know there will be a change? What are we going to measure that will tell us whether or not we've improved? What changes can we make that will result in improvement? What are the interventions going to be? And then you plan, do, study, act, make some adjustments, and repeat. A slightly similar looking figure shows Peter Pronovost and colleagues' strategy for translating evidence to safer practice, summarizing the evidence, identifying local barriers to intervention, measuring performance, and then ensuring that all patients receive an intervention. All of these steps are important. I would say, in particular, something that is very relevant to this audience, to all of you, is identifying local barriers to implementation, walking through the process to see when frontline clinicians attempt to perform the intervention, what doesn't work. Where are the failure points? And then what can you do to make it easier at that point to do the right thing? These things need to occur within a context of a safety culture. So it's important to ideally to intervene both at the level of the system and at the level of the individual practitioner. We would like to ensure that all patients receive the intervention. And this is probably the hardest thing. I would say that internationally we have done the least work on translating evidence to actual practice We have lots of trials and lots of studies that provide evidence for one treatment being superior to the other, but that does not mean that they're being implemented successfully. We want to make sure that all patients, or nearly all patients, reliably receive the intervention that is intended. These interventions need to fit within each hospital's current system, including local culture, taking into account local barriers, and taking into account resources that are available. We talked about four E's of ensuring that these things happen, engaging both the hearts and the minds of practitioners, educating them what could be done, executing the intervention, helping them perform it, and then evaluating how it worked. Out both intervening, but talking about patient safety research in general, there is a great need for more research in patient safety, particularly in developing countries and countries with transitional economies. We just don't know what the problems are, what problems are highest priority, what we should do, and how those things are going to work. Additional skills, like you've acquired to some extent in this course, are beneficial. Research ethics are important. We must take them into account. Mentoring and mentored research experience is crucial. Proposal writing skills, identifying funding sources, very important. And it's also important to be able to continue to learn. There are online resources, and I'll talk a little bit about those things. This has been quite a short course, a little bit of an overview of patient safety research, and I hope it helps whet your appetites for doing this kind of work, or if you are already a researcher, perhaps converting your work to some extent to the very, very important problem of patient safety. If you are just starting out, in particular, you will need additional skills, particularly those of basic epi and biostat. It's very important to have data management skills also. I think that almost all of our work at some point or other requires survey research methods, so some understanding of how to write questions, what we're trying to evaluate, and how to do that by asking questions is very important. And of course, writing and dissemination skills are always important. The research protocol is crucial. This is the heart of any endeavor, and this should always be done before you do anything. For those of you who are fortunate recipients of WHO small grants in patient safety, we've asked you to prepare a protocol, and you even prepare, you even are giving online presentations of your research question. It's significance, the design of your study, including subjects, entry criteria, recruitment criteria, physical issues, including, very importantly, sample size considerations. You need to correct things in an ongoing way with ongoing quality management. You need to create then an analytic data file that can be used for statistical analysis. And it's always important to back up and store your data in a way that it can be retrieved, given to other people to share, or reproduced and replicated. In doing surveys, the first step is always, after you have your questions, identifying the concepts that you really want to measure, and then either selecting good existing instruments, this is easier, or designing good questions on your own, this is a little harder. You need to assemble the instruments for study. You need to then administer them. And you do need to make sure that they work, that they are reliable and valid in your population. There are many kinds of writing that are important and many academic researchers, but presenting things both at meetings, but also to our colleagues to convince them to do things are very important. Press releases, writing of policies and protocols and guidelines, these are must be simple enough that people can understand and use them. And writing grant proposals, of course, is important. Research ethics is crucial to everything we're doing. We want to do no harm in doing our research. Also, basic principles are respect for persons, for patients, beneficence, trying to do good rather than harm, and justice, being fair. Almost everything should be reviewed before it is done. Anything that involves human subjects should be reviewed by an institutional ethical review board. And there are many considerations that are special for the developing world. What are appropriate comparisons groups? Perhaps is a placebo appropriate or not? Can interventions be afforded, perhaps after a study is done? How is everyone, what's the relationships among collaborators, for example, national and international collaborators? What is everyone's status? What rights do they have to the research that's done? A mentor is someone who doesn't rest until you succeed. And research has shown that the strongest predictor of academic success is having a mentor early on. This can be a single mentor, or it can be a committee of mentors. And you who are beginning your research or who are beginning your research in patient safety should try very hard to identify a mentor, ideally someone on site locally, but it can also sometimes be someone more remote. Something that we at WHO are attempting to do is to begin to form networks so that more mentoring can occur. Proposal writing skills will help us do what we need to do. People need practice in writing proposals. Understanding the elements of a good proposal and the characteristics, including scientific quality, technical quality, and responsiveness to what the funding organization is asking for. Simply identifying funding sources is important. Here are some resources which I've discussed today, and I'll discuss each of these briefly. This is one of my favorite books related to research. It's called Designing Clinical Research by Steve Hulley and colleagues based at the University of California, San Francisco. Designing Clinical Research. I would encourage you to seek out this book. It tells you how to do things. It's written very simply using good educational principles. They tell you what they're going to tell you. They tell it to you. They ask you and test you a little bit on if you've learned, and no chapter is longer than about 5 pages. Perhaps the best online resource for patient safety, at least in the developing world, is PSNet, Patient Safety Net, which is run by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. My full disclosure is that I'm currently on the editorial board of this site, but it does a lot of things in patient safety. It lists virtually every paper published on the topic of patient safety, and it's very, very searchable. They have small primers on particular topics, how to do something or other. Perhaps most of they have other resources, including meetings, funders, and other tools. I think this is very useful. PSNet is the name of this site. Related to this is an online Morbidity and Mortality Conference, WebM&M, and it presents cases from all disciplines of errors and analysis of those errors and what was done to make those things better. So that's WebM&M. For those of you who are interested in surgery, NISQIP, N-S-Q-I-P, is a surgical safety project run by the American College of Surgeons. And here is the web address. Related to patient safety. And you can go to www.jointcommission.org/patient safety. This is one of the things that is one of the resources that's related to patient safety on their website. This is the National Patient Safety Goals, and it describes a specific aims, targets for improving safety that are mandated for hospitals in the U.S., but can also be relevant, at least many of them are relevant, in other settings as well. The Joint Commission is a partner of the World Health Organization, and you can also find some of their programs on the WHO Patient Safety's website. And here, of course, that is www.who.int/patient safety. There are many resources here, including a lot of detailed tools related to the patient safety campaigns that have been launched. I have circled here in orange the case series. The cases in this case are classic patient safety research papers. They are organized along the lines of the research cycle that we have just described. And each of these is a PowerPoint presentation which you can download and use to learn or teach about classic patient safety problems and the methods that were used to address them. These presentations also include interviewed them, and they told us why they did the study, how they thought of it, the resources that were needed, what they wish they'd done differently, and how this might apply to a developing country. So this brings us really to the end of my formal remarks for this short course on patient safety research. We would We'll be getting in touch with you very shortly. Some of you have really hung in a very loyal way from the very beginning. I'm impressed that after the first introductory lecture, we've had a core of perhaps 100 people who have attended, it looks like, almost all of these lectures, certainly many of them. And it's very nice that we have developed such a cohort. We hope that you will tell us when we send you a course evaluation, what you liked and what you wish were better or different about this course, because we would like this to be better. We would like it to meet your needs. Such loyal students. I think that the great hope for patient safety outside of the developed world is people such as yourselves who are currently conducting, would like to conduct research in developing countries, or is likely to be teaching people to do that research yourselves and training the trainer. It may wind up being as valuable as doing the research itself, because that's really what we're trying to do here. We're trying to spread the word about the need and a little bit of how to do this work. As you can see on the screen from Mai, there's going to be a questionnaire on the raft. The questions will be shown under utilities, under the forum, and we will actually post instructions on the site and perhaps even send you. This is the first time that we've ever done this. This is certainly the first time that a patient safety course has gone out on the rafts, and I appreciate the attention of those of you who are viewing via Doodle on the raft. I realize that things are not easy, and I hope that this has met your needs as well. But so let me go to some of these comments, and it is possible that we may have a additional course that follows this one, if that's something that you think would be useful, if there are topics that you think would be particularly helpful, or if you think we should redo this course differently, we're willing to entertain that possibility as well. So thank you. Let me take a couple of these comments. According to me, Anantha says, direct bearing on the model of the healthcare system, especially team of healthcare doctors, nurses, and pharmacists. Anantha, I think that you got the message very clearly. I think that safety is a property of the system of care that where the patient is being taken care of. And all systems have some unique elements. Teamwork and communication are crucial elements of that, but not just how individuals work together, but how they are organized. And so all of these things have very important bearing on safety. They, in fact, create safety or create hazards. And that is where we need to start to work, to study, and then to intervene. Santosh says, according to me, the patient safety has direct bearing on the Santosh, Santosh, I agree completely with Anantha. Now, it's interesting that all three of these comments are exactly the same. I would say that I agree completely with all of Anantha, Santosh, and Himani. Perhaps we have some other questions as well. I think that, to elaborate just a little bit further, I think that something which we, if this were not the case, you could simply take some of the suggestions that I have made and direct them directly in your organization. And that, of course, will not work. Your organization is not my organization. And what is the most important, what are the problems, what are the opportunities? So we have another comment from Santosh. Thank you very much. I thought that you were an excellent audience. I was actually very impressed by the fact that we've had really kind of meaningful question and answer sessions for the last few lectures. I think we've learned gradually how to do this, but I think it's now working quite well. Can I organize an on-site tour at Hopkins or other institutions as part of a patient safety training program? I think this may be possible. This is something that we're going to have to bring back to WHO. This has been done in other cases. We need to figure out how this could be done and how the resources could be organized. But I think it would be terrific. So Himani asks, what is a good way to measure an abstract concept in like patient safety culture in a healthcare organization? And so it's I don't have a very, very simple answer. Perhaps the simplest answer that I have is that there are existing surveys to measure patient safety culture. And I suspect that those surveys, perhaps 70 or 80% of those surveys would be applicable to any setting, because what we're talking about is, do leaders, is this a safe place to practice? What is the relationship? Is it safe for me to talk about problems with my team? Or if I make a suggestion, is it likely to be followed? There are lots of these concepts are very generic across organizations. These surveys are available on the ARC Patient Safety website. They are also available. Some of them are available directly from the organizations, but I've mentioned the Safety Attitudes Questionnaire, the AHRQ Patient Safety Culture Questionnaire. If you simply Google these two, you might get to them more quickly. These could potentially be translated and used in developing countries. As I've mentioned, I think I mentioned on a previous session, one of my students has just left to Gujarat province, where he is going to be translating the Safety Attitudes Questionnaire into Gujarati and then trying to rural hospital. And it'll be very interesting to see, first of all, if it works, how it works, and then what he finds. Xu Chenye says, there are many levels of research evidence. What's the level for qualitative research of patient safety? That's a really good question. So qualitative research, I would say, is observational research. It has relatively small numbers, but it can give you a lot of depth. Qualitative research is more about discovery and more about forming hypotheses than it is about testing hypotheses. Qualitative research can also be very useful when it's used next to or alongside quantitative methods. So, for example, you might do a survey, and then you might interview a few people in great detail, or you might record whether or not people are hand washing, and then you might talk to people and ask them about what are the barriers to following hand washing guidelines. I don't know exactly where it would fit on the pyramid. That's a good question. Emmanuel seems to be the same comment as we saw before. Gazal says, I'm working in a small organization that does not have a patient safety program. Do you agree that START should be developing policies and making staff aware of these policies? I think that the first step should probably be a little bit more exploratory, and that is to try to interview or to do some exercise within your organization to try to see what leaders, clinical managers, unit leaders, influential clinicians, what they think are the top priorities, and then beginning to try to figure out solutions to those problems. If you just start putting in solutions, there's no guarantee at all that people will agree that those things are important. Bruce asks, any additional thoughts on methods for extrapolation instead of the methods that we have, or perhaps, if I understand your question correctly, extrapolated from the results that we have. I think that there are some findings that we already have. There are some solutions that we have identified and some problems that we have identified. For example, the importance of safe surgery, the importance of good hand hygiene, that I think we have enough knowledge that these are universal problems. I think that some additional attention should be paid to seeing what the problem is regarding safe surgery or hand hygiene in your organization. But then many of the tools can be used directly or with some adaptation. Let's see. Al-Shaima says, can I foster my intervention effect in hand hygiene other than in seminars? When and how frequently? Let's see, first of all, I would refer you first to the WHO patient safety website. There are both long and relatively short guidelines on how to launch a hand hygiene intervention program. I think that I think that it depends a little bit on what you are trying, who you're trying to influence, and how often you need to dictate how often you should be posting your assessments. I think that doing it every quarter, for example, might work fine. I think that you certainly want to start out by letting people know what is there, if you can, by what is the evidence for hand hygiene practice now, and then follow up eventually with evaluations that show progress. I think that we are very sadly at the end of our time. And Mutu, who is viewing on Raft, I can't see if you had any questions or if your people had any questions, but I wanted to thank you for being here on Doodle. It's a little bit historic. I think this was a fairly satisfactory experience for me. I enjoyed this, and I felt that as we went through the sessions, that it was working better and better. We were certainly getting more questions, more comments. I learned some things, and I think the discussion was actually quite helpful. I think that the discussion in particular has helped reinforce this tension between knowledge that exists and which comes from developed countries, from research studies, and the need to make sure that things fit into the local setting. I'd like to be able to say that, unfortunately, I cannot provide you with a shortcut to saying this is what you should do right now to improve safety in your organization, because I don't think things work that way. At very least, things must be adapted. Even things that are well proven need to be adapted. You need to see what are the local enabling factors and barriers in your institution. In any case, I hope that this has helped stimulate your appetite or given you some resources that you can use in your own work or in helping others who you're working with. This has been a lot of fun, and I hope that you feel the same way. I would like to encourage you again, if you have questions, please do submit those questions. We would very, very much like to see your evaluations of this course, because without those, we will simply be left with my vaguely contented feeling that things went pretty well, but we really want specifics on how we can do even better. So thank you very much. This is Professor Albert Wu signing off for now at the end of our short course on patient safety research. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.